Okay, so thank you very much, and I would like to start by thanking the organizers to first of all invite me here and also give me the chance to tell you about some of the things we think are very exciting we did the last couple of years. And when I say we, it's me and my collaborators, which are my first two PhD students. I'm very happy with the outcome of these two PhD students. So Nicoleta is now in or starting next month in a postdoc in Rome with Francesco Sertino, and Ulf is in UC Berkeley with David Chandler. Nick is our postdoc, and Jeppe is the head of our center, and a lot of you people know him. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you a bit about strong virial potential energy correlations and consequences from these things for viscous liquids. So we're studying the viscous liquid. So most of what I'm going to show you is in equilibrium, unless otherwise noted. And what we're doing is basically just run traditional MD and just look at what happens. So let's see what happens. Sorry? The job will finish. Okay, so the first thing we're going to look at is the standard single component Lennard-Jones liquid. So the potential is here. We're going to look at what we could call the configurational or excess part of the energy. So that's the potential energy is well known. And the excess or configurational part of the pressure is the virial. So by configuration, I here just mean that these are the things that depends on positions, where the kinetic terms depends on velocities. And I'm going to look at the fluctuations away from equilibrium in these guys. And this is what we find. So here the scale here is normalized by the size of the fluctuations. And as you can see, these two guys, the virial and the potential energy in the instantaneous fluctuations, follow each other really, really nicely.
Okay. Is there a cutoff in this Lennard-Jones potential?
In this case, it's cut off at 2.5, just shifted.
That cut off shifted, so
yeah,
continue.
That plays absolutely no role for these things here. So this is at 80 Kelvin in aggregate units and pressure zero. And we can quantify the correlations by a correlation coefficient, which is 1 if the correlation is perfect and 0 if it's uncorrelated. And here we find 0.94, so pretty strongly correlating, as we also can see from just looking at it. Sorry?
Not just the hydrostatic piece you're looking at?
Yeah, just the pressure. I mean, no off-diagonal terms, anything. Just what goes into your basic thermodynamics. So if we do a scatter plot of this kind of data, and this is actually the same data, more points though, of virial versus potential energy, what we find is an elongated blob like this, indicating strong correlation between the two. And again here, the correlation coefficient is 0.94. So just to ensure you really quickly, I'm not just talking about small spherical particles. If we do a molecule here, really small and simple molecule, we find basically the same thing. So I'm going to show you a lot of different models, and they're all like more or less standard models taken from the literature. This is actually one we made up. It's a really simple toy model of toluene, but I don't want to go into if it's a good model or not. It's basically just a big sphere and a small Lennard-Jones sphere connected together with a rigid bond. Okay, so this is what we find. Do we always find this? No. Then it would probably be trivial. If you look at water, then we can have, at certain state points, we can have a correlation coefficient of 0. And in fact, with a little bit of statistical mechanics and stuff, you can realize that this has to happen close to the density maximum. But I won't go too much into details with this.
Sorry, when you say water, you really mean some particular toy model?
I mean the few toy models, the few standard potentials we looked at so far. So tip 5P is known to have, I think, the density maximum at a reasonable place compared to real water. We looked also at SPCE and I think one more model.
I'm sorry, I'm terribly ignorant about this. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between the sorts of potentials you use there and the potentials you use here?
So actually, I'm gonna come into that when I'm trying to explain it. But yeah. So the point here is just saying that we find this really strong correlations, but not always. So it's not totally trivial.
It depends on the
model.
Kinetic energy includes the rotational part.
Sorry.
Kinetic energy includes the rotational part.
Yes. Yeah.
When you put n, you take the rotation
I mean, just if you just view the model as being some atoms connected with some bonds, then the bonds will give you contributions to the virial, etc. So you just sort of divide everything up in pair potentials and make the molecules out of it.
It's a rigid bond. Or?
Yeah, it's a rigid bond, but you can still calculate the virial and from that. Okay, so some of you might think, I don't know, but that this has something to do with inverse power laws, because it's well known that inverse power laws has the feature, so here I'm writing IPL for inverse power laws, sometimes people call it soft spheres, but anyway, the point is that you have a pair potential, which is an inverse power law in R, and from the way you sort of calculate virials from a pair potential, it's straightforward to show that then you have the virial is the exponent over 3 times u, so we have perfect correlation. So that's like the extreme opposite case of this guy here. Okay? So what I'm going to do in this talk is not to try to convince you that this is very surprising or counterintuitive or anything. I'm going to aim more at showing you the consequences. And before showing the consequences, I'm going to explain you why this is happening. Yes?
I think the answer to my question is helping you figure, but just for the sake of the view, if I interpret your results in terms of something like that, it looks like you have an N of 18. Is that right?
Approximately, yes.
Okay, which has nothing to do with the power law that you put in.
Exactly. So one could think that in the Lennard-Jones potential you have an exponent of 12, which would give you a slope of 4. That's clearly not what we're seeing. So that's one of the. So actually, I think this is my next. No, this is not my next slide. The next one again. So this is just another way of showing that this happens in a lot of systems. If you take the correlation coefficient here, and this is essentially this is proportional to the numerator. This is proportional to the denominator. So perfect correlation is this line here. Above the line is forbidden because of Cauchy-Schwarz inequalities. And down here is then bad correlation, right? And what you see is you have a bunch of liquids that are sort of lying, if not on the line, then very close on the line. And you sort of take into account that this is forbidden area. There's certainly a certain tendency that someone wants to be here, even though it's almost forbidden, so to speak. So these liquids include this single component Lennard-Jones, a system with exponential repulsion, so that's the Buckingham potential. So it's not dependent on that there's a power law in the potential. This is the dumbbell model. I'll show you the isomeric dumbbell model. United atom model for toluene. This is copper. This is a square wheel system. This is the Copeland-Anderson binary Lennard-Jones system, and then OTP model now with united atoms. So there's a couple of molecules in here just to assure you that it's not just when things are small and spherical. There's also, let's see, there's a magnesium copper. So we have a few metals, not so many. And then there's these guys where it doesn't work at all. Okay, so some of these are water. So now we have the different water model here just to show that it doesn't work for that one either. So now let's go to the question, why doesn't it work for water, for example, or methanol?
Are you saying it does work for metals? I mean, are you using a realistic potential?
Well, I mean, I'm using a EMT, effective medium something. So I think it's similar to the kind of potentials Michael Whittam talked about the other day. I think, I don't know.
So it's a pair of potentials or embedded atom?
It's an embedded atom, yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, remember if it's you who said that essentially metals are still spherical things that interact, but then have some connection with the density. So from that, it's not so surprising as we should see that it seems to work for these things. But I mean, we only tested like two models, unless we're counting Cope and Anderson as a metal, which I don't know if we should do after the talk the other day, but definitely it works for that. Okay, so why doesn't it work for water, for example? Well, so these water models, they're basically built up of Lennard-Jones spheres and Coulomb points, so charges. So that means that we can write the energy as a sum of the two, and also the virial as a sum of the two. The Coulomb pair potential is an inverse power law, so these two guys are perfectly correlated, because it's an inverse power law. When we go in and look at the data, these two are almost perfectly correlated, even better than the stuff I saw you. But the point is that the prefactor between these two are different, are very different. So that means when you add them up, the sum is not necessarily correlated at all. In fact, as we saw, it can be close to zero as you want. So we call this is the problem of competing interactions. You have something, let's say Lennard-Jones, which would like to, which it does correlate, but then you have some other interaction that sort of destroys the correlation. Sorry.
For the water systems, the dots that are rising or going close to the diagonal, what is this? A decreasing temperature?
It's typically increasing temperature. So actually, the methanol here. So you see, this gets close up to here. This temperature is at 3,000 Kelvin. Okay, so this is not because we think this potential is realistic at that temperature, but just to show as you increase temperature, you're really banging into the hard repulsion of the Lennard-Jones potential and you sort of regain your correlation. So this also shows that these things are a function of state point, but a weakly function of state point. And usually if we look at some liquid and some big region of what we're usually interested in for this model, is either strongly correlating or not. I'll quantify this some more. So usually methanol, we would actually only care about this stuff here and say it's not strongly correlating, because we don't really care about what this model is doing at 3,000 Kelvin. So our conclusion from this is that it makes sense to, I hope you can read this perhaps, otherwise I'll read it aloud, that it makes sense to claim that there exists a class of strongly correlating liquids, just these strong correlations between potential energy and virial. They seem to include van der Waals liquids, and as we just discussed, some metals at least, but definitely not hydrogen bonding or ionic liquids for this reason here. So this is actually something that's important in what I'm going to talk about, that in experiment and in simulations, people observe a lot of different sort of generic features that if you plot this against that, then you get a connection. But then sometimes if there's counterexamples, et cetera. And so the point is that we should not try to explain all liquids with the same theory or the same sort of glasses on. We should sort of take one class at a time, in my mind. Yeah, that's a little funny system, which I'll try not to get into. That's right, this is the square well system. Okay, so what I'm gonna show you and hopefully convince you is that these kind of liquids, the strong correlating liquids, are particularly simple. They have particularly simple physics, and therefore we can hope to understand them better than. I mean, but of course that depends on the glasses you're using to look at things. For other people, maybe the hydrogen bonding liquids are the simplest one, but I'm gonna focus on these guys, strongly correlating liquids.
You don't have silica in this?
I don't think so, because it's if it's a network forming liquid, has the same, if you have directional bonds and these things, then you're gonna be down here somewhere.
But the silicon models do have pairwise interacting with Coulomb.
Yeah, so it's not going to work. Because you also have Lennard-Jones, I guess, or what do you have? I mean, I don't know the model in here. I mean, as I know, yeah.
There's something that I've been just brooding about the whole time this has been up.
Uh-huh.
So you say that the Coulomb part is strongly correlated, which I think means basically a linear relation between U and double.
Yeah, it's perfectly correlated.
And the same thing for Lennard-Jones.
Yes.
And then you say you add them together and you lose the correlation.
Yes.
I don't quite understand. If you add linear functions, you still have a linear function.
Well, first of all, I showed you the data. You want to do it over here? Better.
The ratio of the Leonard Jones and the Coulomb is not fixed and doesn't even need to have the same sign.
So here you have a one-third. So this guy is one-third of this guy. Yeah. This guy is roughly six times this guy.
Uh-huh.
So that means that you would need to sort of write this as some number equals u.
X plus y is not,
yeah, it doesn't work. This this can be shown in a more rigorous way, of course, but the upshot is it doesn't work. Well, depends on what, if you consider the hot sphere as the taking the limit of a high exponent in the soft sphere, then it'll work. In principle. So then you have exactly. Yeah. So I mean, we didn't do that. So I'll let other people do that, I think.
Leonard Jones potentials? Not Leonard Jones. So Cavell potentials. But there it seems like you have a really obvious relation that when the density was really high, so when you're probing the Coulomb part, you have almost perfect correlation, and when the density got low, so you're probing the exponential tail.
Yeah. We didn't check that. Actually, I guess I forgot.
The exponential has a problem of part in addition, or just purely exponential?
This has an exponential repulsion and then an r to the minus 6 attraction. It's close.
Anything across over from the power law.
Yeah, so this is our, so far, our one example of that it doesn't have to be a power law in the mathematical expression of the potential. So actually, maybe I should just stress that here we have the Zhukov potential, which has like an extra wiggle, which is, because this is a logarithmic thing, it kind of looks correlating, but it's not really that good correlating. And we also have, that's not here, but we tried this Leonard Jones minus a Gaussian attraction. That doesn't work either, because you now have two different length scales. So that doesn't work either. Okay, so now I'm going to try to explain you why this happens. We already saw that there's something about inverse power laws going on. But there's a couple of things we have to explain if we're really going to convince ourselves that we've explained this. One is that we're always already talking about that the slopes we're finding is larger than 4. It's not here, but it's roughly 6. The thing I guess I forgot to stress enough was that we were doing NVT simulations. And all the stuff I showed you so far, almost all of it, so keeping volume constant. So this is, again, the state point which has zero pressure. But now if I switch to NPT ensemble, I get this. Okay, so this, if it was just an inverse power law, then this would be hard to explain. And the same thing if you're looking at, instead of the total virial and a total potential energy, you can define a virial and a potential energy per particle. If you look at how they're correlated, they're not correlated very well either. And this is again the same thing point in this guy here. So there's some collective effect going on. The last thing I'll list as things we have to explain is that the classical crystal of Leonard Jones atoms is strongly correlating, down to whatever low temperatures you want to do.
Isn't that a Fabergé thing that the ensemble you use matters?
It should not matter for mean values, but it always matters for fluctuations. And we're looking at fluctuations here. So this is again the crystal.
I'm sorry, you're not.
Sorry. Yes, I am. That's the old deal.
It's fluctuations of quantity, of extensive quantities that are totals over the whole system.
Yes, yes. So this is the FCC crystal set up at 0 Kelvin and heated. And again, you see these, it's most easy to see at the high temperatures here, you see these really elongated blobs indicating strong correlation. If we look at the correlation coefficient, it's really, really high.
Sorry, just minor point, but this would also depend strongly on your lifestyle.
Yes. Yes. So in fact, if you have a barostat and you make it really slow, then you can kind of see that if you look at this, it's sort of going like this, and then you go back, but then over time it's like doing this because the volume is fluctuating. Okay, so we've seen it in the crystal also. In fact, this line here is fitted to the data, to the 1 Kelvin data, which you cannot see, which is like a blob like this, but just way down here. And I'm not sure even it made it into a pixel, but the data is there in the data analysis program. So as you see this, fitting to this point, we can't see down here. You got a straight line that's kind of describing the whole slope of this guy, except that there's some bending going on, which I'll come back into. Okay, so these are things that our explanation has to cover. So what is the explanation? It's this. I hope I can convince you. So we're going to look at the Lennard-Jones potential. That is, after all, sort of the building blocks of most of the simulations. And this is the potential here in black. The dashed line here is the paracorrelation function of a typical fluid state point. And actually, if we go in and look at the fluctuation and analyze where are they coming from, you can sort of identify that they're essentially coming from this region and this region. Okay, so but anyway, so this potential here is an inverse power law. And in fact, it's an inverse power law with 3 times the sort of the exponent that the fluctuation suggested, because the exponent, so the slope I showed you before for this state point, it's a zero pressure state point, was 6.3, multiply that by 3 and you get this guy. So what you see is that, and then it shifted, it actually sort of covers this region pretty well. And this was actually also noticed before, that if you sort of want to fit locally an inverse power law to a Lennard-Jones potential, you get something with an exponent of 18 or thereabouts, at least by this guy, these guys and perhaps other people before. Okay, so this would explain things if all the fluctuations came from here. But when we're at zero pressure, we're sort of down here somewhere, and in particular the low temperature crystal, sort of all the particles should be down here. So why is this still working? Well, if you look at the difference between these two, then you get this red curve here. And as you can see, in the basically the whole first peak, this is to rather good approximation a straight line. Okay, so that means that for what matters, the first peak to a good approximation, we can write the Lennard-Jones potential as an inverse power law plus a linear term plus a rest, which is small. And as we discussed before, that the IPL potential is giving us the perfect correlation. So what about the linear term? Well, if we start about thinking about it in one dimension and reminding that we needed to see this for these correlations, we needed to have constant volume, which would be constant length in this case, one dimension, then you can quickly convince yourself that a linear term does not contribute to the fluctuations. It only depends on density or length in one dimension. The reason is simply that if you like have a fluctuation where one particle moves a bit, this one gets longer, the other one gets exactly the same amount smaller. So the overall contribution from the linear term does not change. This is exact in one dimension. In 3 dimensions, when we go in and investigate it, it's a rather good approximation. So that's our explanation of why we see these strong correlations in the Lennard-Jones potential. So we can say that, in fact, there's a lot of scaling properties that the inverse power law potential have that these kind of strongly correlated liquids inherit, but not all of them. So we say that they have a hidden scale invariance, which I'll get back to. So this is the explanation. Do we buy it? Good.
PV for the linear term is approximate.
Yeah, then it's approximate that it. Yeah. Yeah.
So how that, does that also explain the difference?
Yeah, because this argument requires volume to be constant. Yes. And it also explains why it's a collective behavior, right? Because this term is not constant when you look at the individual particle. It's only constant when you look at the whole sum over the whole sample. Yeah.
Yeah, this linearity is like free volume argument for this trouble. But this is rather specific to this potential. Like, your correlation is more general.
Yeah. So
maybe it should go beyond this.
Yeah. So I mean, we're actually working on that right now to show, for example, for the Buckingham potential. But I'll show you in a minute why I'll say that the you can express this: the particles doesn't know that this is the equation we put in. They see this curve, and this curve can be generated by a lot of different functions to a really good approximation. And let me maybe, I think, jump to that right now.
So this argument here shows that for constant L in 1D, a linear piece doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Suppose you tried to write Newman-Jones as an R to the minus 18 plus an R to some other power, and fudge that other power so that in three dimensions it exactly didn't matter.
I don't think it's a matter of the power. The reason it's not perfect in three dimension is that you can have like transverse movement and stuff like that. So I don't think.
So you're saying there's no power would work for.
I don't think so, but it's yeah. Okay, so I told you before that these things are dependent on state points. So here's a lot of different state points for the single component Lennard-Jones. Each of these lines are an isochore. So actually the one we started with was this guy here, strong correlation indicated by this elongation here. And then I increased temperature, constant volume in steps of 20 Kelvin. And I actually even went to negative pressure here. This line is zero total pressure. It's still NVT simulations. So you see these things work nicely and all these state points, and I'll quantify that in the next slide, and they sort of like fall on the same line, which is consistent with what the argument of the of this linear term, because what happens if we're holding volume constant and changing temperature, still what you see is just some rearranging of the particles. Still the linear term is not going to change much. So the linear term, the point is the linear term only depends on density. So therefore, when you're not changing density, you get straight lines here. This is a crystallized sample, so it actually crystallized from the one of these guys going down here. And there you see the correlation works nicely, just as the perfect crystal I showed you before. And you also see that it also, this thing about lying on the same line survives when you melt the crystal. A big jump here, that's the heat of melting. Okay, so let's look at how does these things look if we quantify the correlation coefficient. Looks like this. So if you look at isochores, these are isochores, we see that when you increase temperature, the correlation coefficient increases, gets closer to 1. So that's consistent with when you have constant volume and you increase temperature, you're banging harder against each other and you're further up on which is a better power law, so to speak. The same thing happens if you look at constant temperature and increased density, which is this way. So again, you enforce particles to bang closer into each other, more power law-like. So what happens if you look at an isobar? So here's a zero pressure isobar. Then you have a competition between the two effects. Because let's say we're decreasing temperature, that would increase correlations by itself. But you're increasing density, which would increase correlations. I don't know if I said that right, but you have two competing things. They do compete. We go down in temperature, constant pressure, the density increases.
It increases the correlation.
The the density, increasing density increases the correlation, but decreasing the temperature decreases the correlation. So luckily for us, the density effect wins, because what we see is the correlation increases. So in this sense, the density effect is more important than the temperature. And why do you say that's lucky for us? Because I promised you to tell you something about viscous liquids. This is not a viscous liquid, but sort of the range where you see viscous liquids is in the cold, dense phase. Right, so this, you can sort of say here we're trying to make viscous liquids, but in this case it crystallizes, but you can sort of hope that other viscous liquids are up here. If we look at the slopes, we sort of see similar trends that the explanation sort of makes sense. One thing I'll note here is that if you look at the slopes here, they are going towards 4, which we argue that for an isocore should go at should go to really high temperature. But they're going there really, really slowly. Actually, I increased this isocore here to 1,000 Kelvin, and I found a slope of 4.6. So this is what I mean, that the particles never see R to the minus 12. They don't know this R, that that's a mathematical function we put in some sense. So you never try to explain anything about the R to the minus 12. Unless you're at really, really high temperatures.
That reminds me, question I forgot to ask. Mm-hmm. So since the textbook description of non-associated liquids is based on the Weeks-Chandler-Anderson shifting of the repulsive branch of the Leonard-Jones, mm-hmm. you simulate the WCA fluid, is it strongly correlated?
It's one of the things we don't quite understand yet. It is strongly correlating. But some of the other features I'm going to show you is not working for it. And in a sense, it is a weird potential. But we have a paper in ConMed just recently that sort of deals with that. Okay. So just to keep an eye on experimental results, so this is still not viscous, but this is results for argon. I'm going to attempt to show you. So the point is here now, all I talked about now was excess properties or configurational properties. So they're a little bit hard to get at from an experimental point of view. But if we have a system where we can sort of subtract off the kinetic terms, then we're in business. And if we just assume that argon is a point particles, we can sort of subtract off reasonable kinetic terms. And then we can use these standard fluctuation formula for how you get the response functions, for example. This is the Einstein formula for heat capacity. And this means that if we want to calculate, so now I'm not doing any fitting to any power laws or anything. I'm just saying I want for experimental data, which I downloaded from this database, I want to evaluate the correlation coefficient, which is this. And as you can see, these fluctuations here, I can sort of refine up here, which means that from these guys, I can calculate a correlation coefficient. There's a bit of technical issue with this hypervariable here, but so we have to do a single approximation. But anyway, the bottom line is that for these data here, which is supercritical argon, so we're higher temperatures and higher densities than the critical point, we find something that fits very well with a correlation coefficient of 0.96. So this is like the first experimental evidence that this thing is not just a computer thing. Even better than some of the simulations I showed. But of course, experiments are always better than simulation. You should know that. No, I agree. I agree. Okay, so we were of course encouraged by this.
What are you doing exactly, or estimating the variable?
The point is that sort of this is the so from this equation we could get the correlation coefficient because we can get these things from the database, but the hypervariable we can't get. So what we have to do is do an approximation that's sort of similar, that the hypervariable is strongly correlated with the variable. And it's just like the variable is strongly correlated with the potential. And if we go in and do simulations, again of the Lennard-Jones, this works perfectly. So we're pretty certain that this is not unreasonable. But it's under that assumption. Okay, so now I'm going to show you three slides, trying to convince you that this feature, the strong correlation between virial and potential energy, is really a property of the whole energy surface, meaning the potential energy as a function of 3n coordinates. So here is an experiment. This is again this asymmetric dumbbell model, a small aging experiment. Here we have a correlation blob at one state point. Here is another one. So these are equilibrium data. And the blue is what happens if I jump the temperature from this temperature to this temperature, keeping volume constant. And what you can see is the system, to really good approximation, just follows this line. So this correlation between virial and potential energy is not a, you don't have to be in equilibrium. But that's, of course, also consistent with the explanation that it's just a matter of, if you are at constant volume, the linear term gives the same contribution every time.
Just this surprise that you have some sort of quasi-equilibrium, I mean, because you are coupling to a thermostat.
Yeah.
System does not really realize that it's pondering.
You could say that, but our interpretation is really that this feature is really a feature of the whole energy surface. And I'll show more data to show this. But just, I mean, if you look at this, you can sort of say, okay, what else could the system do? Well, if it happened to be water or another non-strongly correlating liquid, it could do a lot of other stuff, which looks really messy. So this is one of the reasons I say that strongly correlating liquids are simple, water is messy. But interesting for other reasons, of course. Okay, so this is taking things a little further. So this is these equilibrium fluctuations falling, strongly correlating, falling nicely on a line on an isochore. What I did here is to generate different glasses from this state point. Then these are just essentially different cooling rates. Six different glasses, I think there is. As you see, they fall nicely on the same line. Again, just suggesting that this is just a property of the surface, doesn't matter how you got where you are. And even if we take find inherent states, so these are like local minima in the energy surface found by steepest descent. If you do that from this state point, you get this one, if you, and et cetera. And again, these, to a really good approximation, just falls on the same line, suggesting that this is just a property of the whole energy surface.
So here you're taking fluctuations over many different inherent
structures. This is actually just one, each of these are one inherent structure. In the next slide, I'll show you more inherent structures. But this is just so if you take one state point, one configuration from here, quench it, you find something that falls on this line. To a good approximation. So this is now the Wanström binary Lennard-Jones system. And this temperature is actually the one I showed you some data for last Thursday. It's a TC, basically, or at least very close. So these are the equilibrium fluctuations. And what you see down here is the result of a very recent collaboration with David Rodney, who did some interesting stuff down here. We discussed over the last week or two. So let's zoom in on what we have down here. So here's different kind of things. So the green stuff here, that's inherent states found from quenching from equilibrium. The blue stuff is transition states found from the transitions found in equilibrium. So I found a transition in equilibrium, like I described last Thursday, and I gave the transition to the net method, and then we can find, or David found the transition state between these two things. So that's the blue thing here. We can also, given a configuration with the ART method, just find a lot of transitions around whatever is there. That's the black guys here. And finally, what he did was to find transitions and whatever, find a final state that was lower than the one you started with, then you accept it, it's sort of like attempting to go downwards, then you get the red stuff here. As you see, it's not perfectly on this line, but what can you expect? But it's really, really close. And in fact, it's consistent with this thing we also saw from the crystal, that things are like tend to like have a little bit of curvature in that direction, so negative curvature.
What's the significance of looking at transition states?
The point is just here that this correlation, these are just different ways of finding particular points on the energy surface. And it seems like whatever we do, it's a really good approximation, this holds. So this is just like stressing this this point even further. So I'm not, except for this, I'm not going to do any inherent dynamics or anything like that.
Does the correlation hold for harmonic system? Is there one to do analytic calculation? So basically down there, it's just
wobbling
around, and so
how yeah. The thing is that here you have different enhanced states, and actually for the crystal, remember it worked for like 1 Kelvin, which without knowing the numbers, I'm sure that's really really harmonic, but I still found a slope that's like 6 or 5 perhaps. And the point is that this is an anharmonic property. So it's like it's just like your harmonic crystal has no expansion coefficient. So you need to go to higher order to find the and it's the same thing here basically.
Sorry, I did not understand. Yeah, because the correlation works well if you are in the constant volume.
Yes.
Therefore, you don't care about anharmonic effects.
No, that was like an analogy with that just like you, to calculate the expansion, mm-hmm. you had to go to higher order. So you have to do to calculate the correlation. Mm-hmm. It's done in great detail in one of the papers I sort of quoted here, not this one.
Somehow. You didn't answer my question.
Sorry.
If you do it for harmonic tuner, harmonic system,
yeah.
Then you probably can calculate all the fluctuations.
Yes. Yes.
Is there a good correlation?
Yes.
So isn't this the rationale why you find also good correlation?
No, because here we're not looking at the fluctuations within wells because we're quenching all the time.
So here
we're looking at the correlation between different wells, the wells of the system. The wells of the system. We're looking at the correlation between different inherent states, essentially, the inherent states that the system chose to visit. So it's more like that we're doing.
No, but I think the pair potential is never harmonic.
No, but
you don't.
Well, but he's calculating the total variance we can expand in terms of non-coordinates.
Yeah,
that's what I. This is my question. If we do this, we get this result.
You do get strong correlation.
Yeah, but you'll get it with a different...
Different slope, yeah.
That's not our point.
So from this understanding of this underlying power law on underlying inverse hidden scale invariance, we can sort of start predicting different things. And the first thing that we're going to talk about is what was already seen experimentally, namely density scaling. So what people realized is that if you look at your relaxation time as a function of temperature and density, so here you have zero, so this is a atmospheric pressure, but then these data here are different densities, different molar volumes here. If you have this kind of data, then plotting it in the right way, you can get all this data for this system here to collapse in one line like this. And the conclusion is that the relaxation time is not a function of density and temperature, but a function of this guy here. So there's two things here to note. One thing is, this was something that people found just empirically, and they just changed gamma empirically and figured out when did they find the collapse. So two things here. First of all, another reason why these things we're seeing is perhaps relevant at really viscous liquids, which we can't even find in simulations. That is that, as you see, I showed you before, that like the slope, which is this gamma, slightly depends on state point. But the point is, when you study these kind of things, you really, really don't change state point much. So here they changed density by 2%. So really minute changes, and the relaxation time changes by a factor of 100. Okay, so you can say it's a regime where you don't change density state point a lot, but a lot happens. So this might be a reason that it doesn't matter so much that we found that there's slight dependence on state point.
So,
how can you tell that it's a power law?
That was
a heated debate about is this the right form of scaling? And correctly, if you change density by 2%, then you could put a lot of different functions into here and get a large collapse. That was exactly one of the arguments. Why should we believe in this thing? So that was like a great discussion going on. Is this the right form of scaling, and what is the explanation? One thing that was realized at some point was that this does not work for hydrogen bonding liquids. This works perfectly in our picture because they're not strongly correlating, so they don't have this in scale variance. So actually, as you can guess, that
this was the idea was if you OTP more or less it's an inverse power law. For inverse power laws, the static properties depend only on such a combination. Right. If you believe in MCT, if you have the structure, you have the dynamics.
MCT.
So here's an argument not relying on MCT. But it is on the power law.
That's what happened. That's what Turner did.
So, yeah, yeah. Okay. So, but at least, of course, the point is.
It's a theoretical argument, not an argument based on the experiment.
So the point is, if there is an underlying power law, you would expect this. Okay. So we showed that this works also for simulations, and Kuslovich and Ruland also showed it for. So this is actually OTP, but it's time model of OTP. But the point is that. Now, for us, gamma is no longer just an empirical fitting parameter. It's the number we're going to look at the fluctuations. So the fluctuations, what apparent inverse power law is they're suggesting. And that's what we did here. We just looked at the fluctuation, and they tell us to use this exponent. And the other ones, which are just shifted, are just showing that other exponents doesn't work. And this is the data without a scaling. So as you can see, this works very well. And so now we sort of changed gamma from being an empirical scaling parameter to something we can determine independently. Another thing you can argue is that if you have strong correlations and you have separation of timescales, which you have in these viscous liquids, so it's basically the structural properties that are fluctuating slowly. You put this into the fluctuation dissipation theorem, you can show that these frequency-dependent thermodynamic response functions are proportional to each other, more precisely their imaginary parts here. This is actually what we started by finding, and then we traced it all the way back to the first graph I showed that this is where it's coming from. I'm not going to go into details with this, but just saying that this is perhaps a way to do what we did up here in experiment, because if you know two of these guys, you can get gamma and you can check that it's the same you get from scaling, which you would not expect unless you sort of believe that this is the picture. And we do have some interesting results on that, but unfortunately the error bars on these gammas from experiment are a little bit large so far. Okay, so we found all these properties and started to make predictions. But in a sense, what we do is, remember, we're saying, okay, we have a lot of systems where there's a Lennard-Jones potential. We can approximated by another potential where one term, the linear term, is approximately doesn't contribute, blah, blah, blah. So like building approximation upon approximation. So what we found last year was that we can actually, we can generate all these predictions and a lot more by just one single assumption. So it's like a fresh start from a theoretical point of view. We just do one assumption and derive a bunch of properties, and that's what I'm going to show you. Well, actually more than it, that they work. And the assumption we're doing is this. So we consider two state points, one and two. And now we sort of do a pairing of microstates or configurations. So now you should not think of the configurations that comes out of a simulation, but all the configurations that you would have to sum over to do statistical mechanics. And now we do a particular pairing, which is sort of illustrated here. We're saying that they should be the same, these two microstates, in reduced units. So by reduced units, I mean they're multiplying by density to 1/3. So we say one is just a simple scaling of each other, the other. And here, capital R is a 3n dimensional vector describing the whole configuration of the whole microstate.
But this size should actually be the same.
Yes, we're not changing the potential. And you're right, I just, sorry, I just took this figure and I thought it was pedagogic, but just, so you're the first one to notice that, but that's correct. Okay, so this is just a pairing we can always do. So requirement for what we call isomorphic, these two state points to be isomorphic, is the following, basically that the two Boltzmann factors should be proportional, with a prefactor that only depends on state point. So that's the requirement. We do this assumption. I guess you can sort of, if you sort of think back to your statistical mechanics, you can sort of think that, that well, if you do this, then you can derive a number of properties between these two states. You can think of it as sort of a generalization of what's... You can think of it as a sort of a generalization of the requirement or what's true for an inverse power law. If you take an inverse power law and put it in, you find that for state points related in this way, this is exact with a one here. So it's sort of a way of generalizing the inverse power laws, which we sort of see that we see a lot of features from. Okay, so let's first do what we call a direct isomorph check. And if you take the logarithm of this guy, you get this. Basically saying if you take configurations at density 1 and transform into density 2 in this way, then you should get an energy which is related in this way, so basically linear. Okay, so this is what we did. Of course, it should be true. I mean, it should be true for all, I wrote all physical relevant state points. And one can discuss what does that mean. But here we tested it for a lot of, not so much state points, but configurations. And here we just took a lot of configurations from a simulation at state point 1. I took a lot of simulated state point 1, took a lot of configurations, scaled it to another density, and looked at what is the energy. And this is what you find. And you find a really, really, really good approximation. We don't change density that much, but never mind. We find a collision coefficient of 0.999. So this is sort of indication that there is a hope that this works for all physical relevant configurations, at least the one we looked at so far. And actually, you can sort of from the slope here, you can actually say what should temperature 2 be for this to be true. This is a way to find the new state point, which might or might not be isomorphic with this state point. Okay, so one thing you can see here is that this guy here is different from zero. This would be zero if it was just an inverse power law, or if we changed densities so little that it didn't matter. So that's an important thing, that this is not zero, because that would be the logarithm of this guy. Okay. So from this, we can derive a bunch of properties and more than I have here. If you look at this one, this structure, so everything here is in reduced units, which means you should make your properties dimensionless without referring to the potential, only density and temperature. And this is again, this is how we show all the scaling properties on inverse power law, so we sort of can inherit these things. So since the So this the structure is sort of straightforward to see if all the Boltzmann factors are proportional. You have to sum all them to get your partition function, Zustandssumme, and then this proportional factor get cancels. So these two state points have the same probability. So therefore the structure is the same, because all microstates have the same probability. And therefore the excess entropy is the same. And you can also show that the dynamics, again, in reduced units are the same. That's perhaps easier to see in the formulation here of the energy surfaces. Remember, this is three-dimensional vectors. You're basically looking at the same energy surface, just scaled and shifted. So you get the same dynamics. And this should this includes any higher order correlation functions or whatever you want to look at, from the prediction at least. From this, we can actually also show that you should expect real and potential energy fluctuations. So we didn't assume it here. It comes out of this one assumption. And it also comes out that these isochores should be straight lines that as we saw, to a good approximation.
This is true only for Newtonian right now.
It's actually true also it's easy to see in Newtonian dynamics. Just put things into Newton's laws. But you can actually show it also for other dynamics, and it's done in this paper here. Yes. Required, you do things in the right scale units. So perhaps I should say, well, this is a bad place to say it, but let's go here. So we have this series of papers in JCP, which is now up to 5, and then so all this stuff is in there. Okay, so now I'm going to test this by simulations. And I'm going to do this. There's different ways of doing this. One way is to take one of the invariants on these isomorphs. So I showed you how to identify points, state points that are isomorphic, and then from that you can generate a whole line in your phase diagram. So what I'm doing here is to say, okay, I'm going to take one of my invariants on this line, keep it constant, and see if the other guys follow, the other invariants. And what I chose to do is to keep excess entropy constant, because then I don't have to calculate it, actually. and you can show that for this property here, which is turns out to be the gamma we've been talking about a couple of times, you can read as being, say you want to change density by 1%, keeping excess entropy constant, how much should you change temperature? So, and that's actually what I did. I changed density 1%, asked the system how much you'll then change temperature, and go on. And this you can calculate from these fluctuations in this way. So this is actually the linear regression slope. And it happens to be also the slope of the isochore in this virial versus potential energy plot. So let's see how these things work. Well, actually, let's see how it doesn't work. because we'll start by, just for reference, the isotherm of the Copan-Anderson system now here, changing density 9%, you see that the structure doesn't change much, which is what we used to, but it just changed a little bit. And actually, you sort of roughly, you can say that the height of the peak changes roughly the 9% you changed density. And remember, we should do this in reduced units, sorry. So what happens if I change density but change temperature at the same time to keep excess entropy constant? Then I get this. And I hope you agree that this is a really good approximation. The same curve we're seeing. There's a little thing going on here which we don't understand, but these are all things that are not approximations, but I would say that it works surprisingly well.
Does it not work for the BB?
The BB and the AB is in the paper, and it works perhaps a little less, but what you see is sort of like things like this popping up more. Yeah.
How the quality of the thing depends on the density you look at. Because if you go to density more like equilibrium density, I mean, one sees a scaling. I mean, in the diffusion, I see a scaling as you have it for the A particle, one for the B particle, but it's different scale. Therefore, I would imagine that eventually, when you go to low density, the system must see that it's binary. and say I don't, and say, don't scale exactly.
It's not a question of binary. It's a question of these things breaking down when you go to too low densities. These things are only expected to be exact for IPL systems.
Yeah.
To me, what's surprising is how well it works.
This is
like the standard density range that we all looked at in the Cobbett-Anderson system for many years.
I mean, at least what I looked at, it works for one component, but what the breakdown is the difference between the two components.
Yeah,
what happened first.
But yeah, okay. But I'm sure you. I mean, did you look at isomorphs? That's the point.
I mean, it was only is.
I mean, the thing is that the scaling with density should be done along the isomorph. Okay. So anyway, so let's go to something more striking. So here I'm doing basically the same thing with the intermediate scattering function. So as I increase density, things go slower and slower and slower. So this is very similar to what we see if we look at an isocore, which we usually do. So here again, it's the changed. Along this isotherm, I change density by 9%, and the dynamics changes by something like 3 orders of magnitude. Again, what happens if I instead go along the isomorph? What I see is this. So here I have 9 different state points, changing density a little bit more than over here, actually, because I didn't want to spend time trying to equilibrate this guy. And what you see is, to any reasonable expectation, these are the same curves. I choose my temperature by
the time
is in reduced units. The intermediate scattering function, I don't have to do anything, but I actually have to do the Q value should be constant in reduced units. So this is to see that this works other in other properties. This is the mean square displacement now for the Lewis-Wanstrom OTP model. And here's actually 2 curves, a black curve and the red dots, which are isomorphic. One of them has 0 pressure, the red one. And the blue one here has the same pressure as one of them and the same temperature as the other one. So clearly neither pressure or temperature is what determines the dynamics. What determines the dynamics is what isomorph you're on. And this is a rotational collision function for the same guy. We'll see. Excellent question. So let's first look a little bit at what other people did. So here I stole some figures from a talk previous in this workshop from Charusita Chakravarti or something, who discussed the so-called Rosenfeld scaling, which says that, for example, the diffusion coefficient in reduced units should be an exponential of the excess entropy. And I forgot to put in an alpha here. And she discussed that this is not really what you see. You might see it at high temperatures, but then it breaks down. Okay, this is a Leonard Jones system. This is Truscott's recalculation of Shree's data. And I think, if I understood the talk correctly, that she sort of reanalyzed the data and got even better data collapse than this. But I couldn't find the reference, so I didn't want to. But anyway, so the thing is that this prediction breaks down, but this still holds. That it's apparently a function of excess entropy. Remember, excess entropy is an invariant on the isomorph, so is the relaxation time. Therefore, you would expect this. Okay. And so here you have an idea that'll work even down to really low diffusion coefficients. Relating this to experiment, something that was observed was what we call isochronous superposition. If you change temperature and pressure, which is what is easiest to do in experiment, so that the relaxation time is the same, then you find that your relaxation spectra for a class of liquids are also the same. So for example, here these are 2 curves, different pressure and temperature. So for example, there's one atmosphere, and then there's something, I can hardly read this, but some number of megapascals. So the same shape. And here's a sort of a quantification of similar things. These are different shape parameters for these guys, plotted as a function of relaxation time, and you see for some systems, like let's say this guy here, it seems like the shape of the curve only depends on relaxation time. So this is what we call a isochronal superposition. And of course, that's also a prediction from what we find, because the shapes are also the same. I mean, the shape, the whole relaxation spectra is an invariant along the isomorph, because it's basically the same dynamics you're doing in the two different state points. So that's very encouraging, I think. And okay, so this is the thing I promised some people yesterday to show as a teaser. So here again, here this is a somewhat more more viscous state point than the one I showed you in detail before. So the black and the red here are isomorphic. These two other guys are isochoric to one of them. And what you see here is chi4. And again, also a higher order correlation function should be the same, because we're doing the same dynamics in reduced units. Works well.
I mean, you know,
when
you talked about NPT and NVT, you said there will be a big difference in fluctuation.
Yes.
Depending on the ensemble.
Yes.
Here, I mean, the chi4 is a flux. I mean, it's a different context, but chi4 is a fluctuation quantity.
Yes, but it's here we evaluated it in NVT ensemble.
No, it's
not. Yeah.
So that's why it's a different context. But
okay.
So you probably have to show that whatever you're showing as invariant would also be true for fluctuations of this kind in time or not?
I mean, the thing is, it's the whole, I mean, the energy surface is the same. So, I mean, yeah, okay, maybe there is some detail there to be shown that like the NPT fluctuations for chi4 is the same. That we'll look into that. Okay, so we're gonna do something. We're gonna jump around between these different state points. So now I'm not in equilibrium anymore. I jump from one to another.
Yeah.
Sorry.
How are you making this jump?
Okay. So let me. So the one we're gonna focus on first is the one from one to two here, which are isomorphic, which is these two up here. So I changed density and temperature instantaneously, and just look what's happened.
So how do you change density?
Let me show you. Oh, well, maybe not show you, but so this is this thing here on a linear scale. This is simulations that Nicoletta did. So this is one of the state points, and now she should change density and temperature, and she decreased density by making the box bigger.
It's the box
thing. Yes. So, no. So it's really a rough thing to do.
So this is a non-equilibrium.
Yes. And at the same time, she changed the temperature of the Noosa-Hoover thermostat we're using. And what you see is that, so you can think of this as picoseconds, that it basically just instantaneously goes down here, and there's no sign of any relaxation. So why should we expect that?
Yeah.
Remember, the two state points have each pair of microconfigurations have the same probability, same Boltzmann probability. So in a sense, except for this small expansion, they're already in equilibrium. And this small expansion is sort of, you can think of it as the glassy, the fast expansion. So this is really striking. I told her to do this, and I sort of expected her, okay. I told her to do this, I expected her to scale the particles, but she didn't. She just made the box bigger.
With a big gap.
Yes. Wow. Well, big. I mean, it's, remember, we're not changing density so much. It's 3% here. Right? So, of course, if you make it huge, then think. But it's small density changes that are interesting in this machine.
There's got to be something going on when this stuff is exploding into this little sliver of vacuum on the side. You can't say that's no change in the dynamics from what was going on before you moved the wall.
Well, okay, I'll give you sort of 2 picoseconds to fluctuate into place.
Because you don't blow out.
Sorry?
You can't say there's no change in the dynamics.
But you didn't do it between isomorphic state points. That's the point.
But he's also got this funny thermostat working at the same time.
Yeah, it's not that funny.
But still.
So let me, so this is.
Okay, so we take this from
pop that wall back to create a 3% space of vacuum and instantaneously change the temperature in the room in some way. You're telling me we're not going to hear anything?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe it.
Okay, well.
But the audience getting positioned, right?
No.
Well, there has to be a sound, a shockwave popping in the wall. Like,
remember, he's when also using a particularly simple interaction potential.
So, so let's see what happens.
There's just something physically going on there that wasn't going on before you made the move, right? There's this empty space and there's stuff flowing into it. It's different dynamics.
If it's very compressed, the expansion would be extremely.
It's the glacier response.
Will expand and reach.
It's the glacier response you're seeing. Sorry?
You have heated it. I mean, you have to shockwave to the particle. I mean,
yeah.
That's why it's hard to calibrate the system. Usually, you have to.
That's why this is striking.
What's the difference you're making?
It's picoseconds. I think this is probably the thermostat we're seeing here. Working.
So it's very severely damped as well.
Yes.
What is that time on this scale?
So this is a usual MD units. But you can think of it as roughly picoseconds.
So I mean, how does that time compare with the time we take a sample which pops with the system?
Yes.
We should have a lot to do with the fact that the Nosey-Hoover thermostat imposes some kind of Stokes-like drag, and you've made a large change in the temperature.
That's only going to make it
pull
it slower.
All the relaxation motions, they occur over a very long time, right? And now just the expansion
of the configuration of the particles on both sides,
that would be a very fast process.
And exactly.
But can it be this fast?
Remember, we already seen the structure is the same in these two units, just scaled to the new density. That's the point.
I think all particles, the answer, as I understand, is that if you did look at sort of how much the sound wave needs to propagate from one end of the box on the other, it will be order of unity in these units.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
And the ripples that you're seeing are a few of those units before it dies off. So that is actually long enough time for sound to propagate.
But clearly, if you do this with a big enough system, that pressure is going to be accelerating the particles. They're going to get more and more inertia, and they're going to go smashing into the other side.
Are you saying all of that stuff is happening?
But if there was a significant change,
it's a 3% spacing,
and it's how and the size.
3%. So 8,000 atoms.
A linear dimension.
Atoms.
So 8,000. 20. So 3% of 20. So you've changed the dimensions.
If you did it with a bigger sample,
it would explode.
It would in fact explode, but that's not what he wants to
see. If you just scale the pollution, then you're gonna have to meet
it. Yeah. Then I wouldn't have got into so much trouble.
You still claim that even if you did the explosive thing, as long as you waited for the thing to equilibrate, then the dynamics would continue.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So I think this is striking, and you agree in different ways. Good. Let's skip this one. So this is just pushing the limit to even lower temperatures, 0.4, which is like below TC, probably have finite size effects. Point is that all these argument doesn't care about system size have to be infinite. So these are two different state points, really low temperatures, same density. And now I can ask, can I make a system which has the temperature, let's see what it was, well, let's just show it, another state point here, which is isomorphic with one of them. So this now has the, so if you look at the blue one, that now has the density of the black one and the temperature of the red one. Again, neither density or temperature is controlling what's going on. It's really whether or not you're on the same isomorph. And this is again Chi4. And these are rather long simulations. Oops. Okay, so I argued that isochores are straight lines in this virial versus potential limit, but this is now the gamma, this slope for an isochore, which is not changing a lot, at least changing less than along the isomorph. And since this guy is the slope here, then we expect the slope changes very, very little. This is like a few percent. We expect the isochores to be straight lines, and this is what we see here. So this is Coben-Anderson here, and here zoomed in. And different, so this is generalized Lennard-Jones system, different exponents, see the same thing, Wahnström, see the same thing, straight lines. And this is like over the range we usually study these systems, where things slow down by three or four orders of magnitude. So these simulations, the really long ones I showed you before, are done on graphics cards, so I'll make a short commercial. We in the next couple of weeks are releasing an open source code for doing molecular dynamics on GPU. So if you're interested in using this, or perhaps even contributing new features to this, then you should contact me. You're not expected to be able to see what's here, just a poster. So now we understand the isochores, and this is the virial versus potential energy state diagram. How does the isomorphs look? Well, the thing is, so now I'm restricting me not to all strongly correlating liquids, but to multi-component generalized Lennard-Jones potentials. And I'm writing just the potential as just writing away that it's sort of really apparent. It's just a sum of two inverse power laws. Then you can write the energy and the virial as a sum of two terms for each power law. And the point is that now you know each of these terms, how they scale with density, because structure is invariant along the isomorph, and therefore you know how these guys scale. This gives you a prediction. This is how they scale. And this gives us your prediction for how they scale with density. This is now reduced density as a function of a reference point. And I can plot this in a way that they should be linear. And as you see, they're linear to a very nice degree. And this is showing how it actually looks in the virial versus potential energy state diagram here. So these are these isomorphs where a lot of things are invariant along. This is two Coben-Anderson systems. This is the Wahnström system, and this is the single component system, single component Lennard-Jones. And one feature here is that this thing, the shape of these things, only depends on the exponents. Because these guys are just basically, you can get that from, you pick a point, and then this is sort of a parametric plot of your parametric expression of this curve in this diagram. So it only depends on exponents, which means that you can scale them all on top of each other. So different systems, different number of components, different compositions, different whatnot. The thing that makes them go on the same curve is that they have the same exponents, the repulsive and attractive part. And if you do different exponents, you get something different. This is the isomorphic prediction for the 8-6 Lennard-Jones. So with that, I mean the Coben-Anderson changed the exponent to 18, keeping the minimum in the same place. This is the prediction, data points post nicely on it, and this is how the other one looked, the 12-6 isomorph. Let's perhaps skip this one and jump to this one. So now we understand a lot of things for these generalized Lennard-Jones systems. We understand the isomorphs. I just showed you, we understand how potential energy and virial goes as a function of density. We have this guy. So we have this differential equation for d log t d log rho on the isomorph. We found that the gamma that comes out of that is to a really good approximation constant, and so then you get this expression. But this is an approximation, but which you could do better, but this works pretty well. So basically, we know everything on this line, on the isomorphs, and across the whole phase diagram here is filled up with isomorphs, which are just scaled versions of each other. This is the isochores. As I explained, these were straight lines, so we write that like this. So the only thing we need, now is to know what is the relationship between, say, temperature and potential energy on these lines. So the temperatures I'm showing here is the one I put into the simulation, but what is the mathematical relationship between temperature and potential energy? And there we borrow a result from Rosenfeld and Tarazona, who derived this thing here with density functional theory that potential energy for some systems is linear in t to the 3/5. I don't claim to understand why this works, but it's been found to work for a lot of systems, and it works also for these, except for the Wernstrom system, for reasons which are in this paper. But so, okay, so now we sort of restricting ourselves to generalized Lennard-Jones systems where this works, because now we know, again, know everything on the isochores. So this actually means that now we have a full equation of state, meaning that you give me density and temperature, and I'll tell you what is the potential energy and what is the virial. And there's four parameters in this, and it's these two numbers and these two numbers. So this means that I can get them from just two state points. So here I'm sort of testing it in a rather tough manner. I'm just saying I use the information from this state point and this state point, and look at the prediction. And all the lines here are the predictions of the equation of state, and all the points of simulations. And as you can see, it works really well. Even sort of predicting that this point is up here, even though we only use the information down here and here, etc. So for me, this is one of these cases where you never know where research is taking you, because we certainly didn't set out to make an equation of state for generalized Lennard-Jones systems. So talked a lot about it, that these systems are inheriting things from IPL systems. And so I just want to remind you that if you look at an IPL system, you have this equation here, virial is equal to gamma over u, where gamma is n third of the exponent. So that means that if this was just an IPL system to some approximation, then all these points here and all these lines should line one line. Okay, so we have achieved sort of understanding something beyond just saying, it's basically just IPL. And my conclusion? Yes, sorry?
IPL, of course, will never give you a liquid gas.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't expect this equation of state to work.
Well, the thing is, I mean, this is an equation of state for one state. So I don't even know if that's the right word. But in principle, I could do the same thing for the crystal and then calculate free energies and all that stuff. But I didn't go into that. I'm probably not going to be there. Let's see. So you of course you're stuck to the sort of what state you're in where you start, and then you sort of, so this, you can think of this as a really extrapolation from where you start. You sort of just assume that gamma is can be approximated to be constant, and then you just see what, I mean, eventually it's going to fail, of course. It's an extrapolation. We could also just take, there's a well-defined procedure of how you take whatever state point you have and get your best fit for these four numbers. So here I just tested it by just being a little tough on the system. Or the question. So this is my conclusion, which I have 4 minutes to go through. So just reminding you, we just made one assumption, this one. And from that, we derived a lot of properties. A lot of them we showed by simulations. That's more in the papers, which I didn't show. And we also, some of we hadn't tested yet. Some of them are consistent with already existing experimental results. And we're working on sort of going beyond that, actually, showing, confirming predictions that we didn't know before we started. So again, what we predict from this is that on the isomorphic curves, we have invariance of excess entropy, structure in reduced units, dynamics in reduced units, including higher order correlation functions. And from this, the structure, we showed equations for the shape of the isomorphs for generalized Lennard-Jones systems. Combined this with the isochores being straight lines, and gave us an equation state. And I showed you, and perhaps convinced some of you, that jumps between isomorphic state points instantaneously, and there's also efforts in trying to show that it actually works in experiment. And then we can talk again. So, okay, sorry, I even got more. I forgot. So I still have 3 minutes, perfect. So this whole understanding here also gives us what we call an isomorphic filter. So consider theories for what controls the relaxation time of a liquid, or here formulated as a diffusion coefficient. So if you And for experiments, at least you can forget this thing about reduced units. The difference between reduced units and real units changes very little in experiment compared to the orders of magnitude you change diffusion coefficient or relaxation types. So what you must require of a theory is that it's consistent with isomorphs. Because we have all these things that works for isomorphs, and in fact it's exact for inverse power laws. So if you want your theory to work for these liquids, or more exactly for inverse power laws, it better be consistent with this. That means that if you have something on the left side, which is isomorphic invariant, what you have on the right side better be isomorphic invariant also, because otherwise you're in trouble. And if you look at this guy, this is formulated here, and let's just assume this is a reduced units, then the configurational entropy is an isomorphic invariant, because that's counting the numbers of minima. And what we do, changing from one isomorphic state point to another one, is just shifting the energy surfaces so they have the same configurational entropy. And then you have a temperature here, and something that looks like a constant here. So that's a problem, because now this is isomorphic invariant. The excess, the configurational entropy is isomorphic invariant. This term is not. So some of you will say, wait a minute, didn't Sri Sastry show that this Adam Gibbs equation worked? Yes, he did. So this is the result of another very recent collaboration from the last couple of years, last couple of days. So this, I got the data from Sri, and now I transform it into this reduced units here again. And this is basically looking the same as the fits he had. And the point here is that this thing here, which is the A in the Adam Gibbs thing, it depends on density. Okay, how should it depend on density to be consistent with what we see? Well, it should depend like this, because then you have rho to the gamma over T here, which is an isomorphic invariant, and then you're back in business. So I'm not saying that this shows that this is right. I'm just saying it's compatible with the isomorphs. So let's look at this, and this is what we find. This is just these A's for different densities. And if you accept that the very lowest density here is perhaps an outlier, at least I hope so, because if I fit this here to get the gamma, I get 5.05. And what I got from the thermodynamics, something apparently completely unrelated to this, I got 5.16. I don't think I could have hoped for a much better agreement. So, and with that, I think, yes, I thank you for your attention.
So, if I remember correctly, the A in the Adams Gibbs theory, is that an equilibrium property generally?
Well, I mean, I don't really know. I mean, it's
was that an equilibrium property? And of course, there's many versions of the Adam Gibbs theory.
Well, in the Adam Gibbs original formula, it is a thermodynamic.
So the only question is, whatever in the approximate version of it, whether it would be consistent with this density scaling.
Probably not.
Probably.
But on the other hand, I think in terms of this isomorphs, so what you're using in the Adam Gibbs is configurational entropy, I mean, as a starting point in discussing things. It may work, but I don't know if it's a useful exercise to try to prove that the original Adam Gibbs formulation is consistent.
Yeah, it's hard to see how should the exponent get it.
A transition theory is the modern version of it, and it also relates that A, I believe, thermodynamic properties.
So basically, you can go through all theories and say, okay, how should that be formulated to be consistent with this? And we did that for a number of these theories in this paper.
Is this any different from saying that the theory has to apply to inverse quorum?
No, so the limit of going to perfect correlation is inverse power laws. What's new here is sort of the amount of systems where this requirements make sense. But yeah, I mean, somebody could have said that years ago. Said Adam Gibbs is not, well, you could say to be consistent with inverse power laws, you would need this.
I guess sort of one way of stating this is that this is sort of a new perturbation theory for liquids, where you recognize that a lot of a large class of potentials can be written as a piece which is a repulsive power law, which is not the power that's in the perturbational.
Exactly, exactly.
Plus corrections which, in fact, do not perturb your scaling that you get from the inverse power law potentials too much.
Yeah, so some properties it doesn't inflect, other properties it does affect. I mean, bulk modulus it affects a lot because of the change with volume. Shear modulus doesn't affect.
But you don't have time to tell us about WCA.
No, I just say that sort of putting these things really to the test, we took the Copenhagen-Anderson, took out the Lennard-Jones potential, put in inverse power laws instead, the ones that these things suggest should work, and we found the same dynamics as the original Copenhagen-Anderson system, even though it's just inverse power laws put in.
The principle underlying so-called new perturbation theory would be to build in something that maintains a strong correlation.
Yes.
Which, of course, in the WCA theory, saying the attractive branch doesn't affect the structure is largely the ansatz.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way back, of course, to Van der Waal and Witten and others. Mm-hmm. But the next step was relating the repulsion to a hard sphere potential.
Yeah.
A very sound theoretical basis, and you can build up a systematic thermodynamic perturbation.
Yes.
But none of that, of course, was aimed at also trying to organize dynamics. Right?
So Bachir and Tashu showed that the dynamics is all wrong. It's much too fast for the VCA version of the Copenhagen-Anderson.
And
so what we showed is that, well, if you put in another repulsive potential, namely the inverse power law suggested by looking at the fluctuations, you get perfect match with the dynamics.
Well, that one's very conceptually difficult for me, as we discussed. In the real world, there are attractive and repulsive forces, and the IPL has only repulsive forces.
Yes.
And so if I'm Newton and I have a repulsive and attractive force, you're sort of saying you can reproduce the Newtonian dynamics by using a cleverly chosen repulsive force.
Yes, provided that what you're controlling is density and volume. So basically, so from that point of view, the only thing the attractions are doing is to get you to the right volume at whatever pressure you set. But if you just say, okay, I'm going to determine the volume, which is what we can do in the simulations, you get the same.
I mean, the partly consequence of the fact you're always at densities with the particles of the most largest probing your repulsive particle potential anyway.
No, remember this. I mean, it works also at zero pressure, provided you're cool enough. So it is high density, but it's not like they're all crushed up on the R to the minus 12 as I showed you in the beginning. So it's really depending on this linear term to sort of
But if you would have a real system that has, let's say, three body interactions and that you don't know about it, or gives you the structure and you try to reproduce it with a potential as a pair potential, and you find that it's more or less algebraic form again, so you think that this will work?
Well, that's a good question, which we should probably look into it at a point. I mean, if you look at argon, I mean, there are three body terms in there.
How do you address the question? So you have three body interactions in the element. But how do you then propose a repulsive?
Yes, I know it's three body interactions. I do the simulation, but I tell him the interaction, and I give him as many configurations as he wants, GFR, whatever that he asks for, but not the potential.
Then I would look at the fluctuation that gives me the exponent, and if you also give me the heat capacity, then I know what is my prefix of my exponent to work, and then I'll try, and then we'll see what happens. But I think this is not too far away from what kind of happens with the argon, right? Because real argon has three body interactions. We can actually simulate it with reasonably, to some degree, that I don't even know how to quantify, with pair potentials. But if you go in and look at the experimental data and ask what is the correlation coefficient, I get 0.96.
mean, presumably just by whether or not this works depends on the two-body potential. It must depend on the exact form of the three-body potential.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So one thing, I mean, we are far from the state where you can give me a potential and I'll tell you what it's going to do. But allow me to do one equilibrium simulation and I can tell you a lot. That's the state we're at.
No, so this is sort of different from, I mean, what will not work is if I got a lot of configurations and I tried to calculate GFRs, I'm trying to calculate an effective potential from there, that will not work. So if there's no potential, it's free body. So you're sort of going one step grosser, which is to calculate two thermodynamic quantities.
Yes.
And looking at their correlation.
I mean, that's all what I had for argon, right? I mean,
if the correlation doesn't work, then game over, right?
Sure.
You can't do it.
Sure.
So also, I guess it's not a universal solution.
No, of course. It's.
Also, you are choosing to look at only the volume fluctuations, or galactic zero, S-type symmetry fluctuations, which does not change free volume correlation very much.
Yeah.
And in reality, there are six components.
Mm-hmm.
And a higher temperature, the good partition function, the good partition sort of equalize them all together. But at low temperature, this the equation may be the pressure fluctuation and shear fluctuation might deviate.
Yes. Yeah. So we're sticking to we're sticking to the thermodynamic fluctuations. But we do find predictions like, for example, that the shear modulus is invariant along an isomorph, whereas the bulk modulus is not. So that's sort of the other way around of what you would think. But yeah.